Welcome to Charting the Course, a podcast from Full Sail Capital, dedicated to providing you with insights, assurance, and confidence to grow and manage generational wealth. Full Sail Capital is a fiduciary registered investment advisor managing more than $1 billion with a focus on integrity, competency, and transparency.
My guest today is Zach Reynolds. Zach sits down to discuss three of the most timely and popular topics facing investors. If you find any material or reference interesting and would like to learn more, you can find those links in the show notes. I know you'll enjoy our conversation and hope it serves you along your journey. Zach, thanks for coming by today.
Thank you.
Asked you to come by to do a sort of quarterly, annual, we're not exactly sure on the time frame yet, but frequently asked questions we've been getting. And the topics that we're going to address, which may or may not have some overlap, are Bitcoin, Tesla stock, and the 2020 election cycle. And for the sake of clarity, so you don't have to say it, is it fair to say that these may not be the most financially impactful questions, but they are some of the more frequent and emotionally impactful questions?
Absolutely.
And I'm not sure which one you want to start with, but we're just going to go right into the election cycle first. Does that work for you?
Sounds good.
I figured the best place to start here was for everyone to say who they voted for and why. In all seriousness, it goes without saying that this feels like we are walking around landmines given the current political climate, and I'm just trying to add a little bit of levity. So, Zach, without sharing them, do you have political viewpoints and opinions on current issues?
I do have those things, yes. And actually, I'm the last remaining member of the Bull Moose Party, and one of these days we're going to get Teddy Roosevelt reelected. I'm just going to tell you that.
So, how do those political opinions that you hold affect your outlook on the market?
As little as possible. And that recognizes, though, that we all have certain cognitive and behavioral biases, and I'm not immune to those. But generally speaking, I don't think my own personal political viewpoints or preferences should have a big role to play in how we invest client money.
How do you do that then, either emotionally or tactically?
Discipline. Discipline, discipline. Our CEO, David Stanley, has the phrase that discipline trumps conviction. That's how we approach investing money. We don't allow, you know, political convictions or thoughts or feelings about the market, whether we think it's overvalued or undervalued at a particular point in time, to override our discipline, which means working with a client, setting an asset allocation, rebalancing as appropriate. That's really the only way I think we can avoid making behavioral mistakes. And we see it so often with clients. We have to be professionals here.
I know you wanted to wait as long as possible to address the election. Why was that?
The more time that goes by, the more clarity we have. So that's one great thing. I mean, there were a lot of unknowns in the post-election period. I think a lot of those have gone away. We know who's going to be president for the next 4 years now.
As well as the Senate makeup now.
Indeed, right. And that changes the equation somewhat too. And then the other is calm. And I know as we're recording this, I'm not sure I describe the country as calm right now. But as we make investment decisions and we talk to clients, we recognize that a lot of these issues, it seems like more than ever, almost anything you talk about can have some political angle to it, whether it's wearing a mask or investing in the S&P 500. We have clients from across the political spectrum, and we view our job as to grow and help families transfer generational wealth. And that means we're going to be investing across a lot of different congressional makeups, a lot of different presidencies. And it really, in my view, is not super productive to get caught up in any one or the other.
You mentioned clarity. What were some of the topics that you want to get some clarity on going forward with regards to political legislative issues?
Right. So now that we know that we're going to have effectively Democratic control of the White House and Congress, I think there are kind of three areas that we're looking at. The first is going to be stimulus. We know that Democrats are in favor of more direct payments to individuals. So in the short run, that is probably a good thing for the economy. We saw in 2020 what happens when you send checks out to people. They tend to spend them. And so we saw a nice boost in all sorts of consumer goods and things like that. So that's kind of what we expect to happen. And we'll have more clarity on that in the short run. One other important thing, and this is maybe less talked about by retail investors, but aid to state and local governments is important to us as investors. We have high net worth clients who own municipal bonds. We tend to buy higher credit quality bonds, so in many cases, we're not as worried that those issuers need direct aid from the federal government, but we do expect to see the federal government come in and help. You know, you can call it a bailout, you can call it whatever you want, but they're going to help some of these struggling municipalities, which is probably going to boost prices for muni bonds in general. So that's a relatively good thing if you own muni bonds. It's not necessarily good if you have cash that you want to go put to work and buy tax-exempt bonds and earn higher income in the future. So that's point two. And then point three would be, of course, taxes, which has the potential to affect everyone.
Are you referring to income tax, capital gains tax, corporate tax, just taxes?
All of the above. There's a lot of opinions out there, but the latest things that I read is the expectation is for potentially ordinary income tax rates to go back to what they were before the last round of tax cuts, which would mean the top tax rate would be about 39.6%. That would not be a surprise to me, just given what we know today. Corporate taxes, that one to me would be a negative for a lot of reasons. I think it was smart that we cut corporate tax rates in the US because they were higher than a lot of our other countries. And that would have a direct impact on earnings per share for publicly traded companies. We saw what a boost it gave when corporate tax rates were cut. So I'm a little bit hopeful that some people might, even on the Democratic side, try to bring some common sense and hopefully we don't go down that road. And then capital gains tax certainly is another thing that I know the further left you go, the more support there is for a policy like taking capital gains rates all the way up to ordinary income tax rates. That would certainly be a negative for investors. But I'm not sure, you know, as we sit here today, that that's the base case.
Appreciate that. So confirmation bias is something that we're going to spend some more time talking about. If you would use the energy industry as an example and tell me about some trades that would have been intuitive back either in 2016 and where you stand today. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think the energy sector is so fascinating because when Trump got elected, he ran on a deregulatory platform that was business friendly. And to be fair to him, he came in and deregulated in many cases. Around here, a lot of people in the energy sector supported him and were excited about what that would mean for their industry. If you look at, from an investor's perspective, the energy sector from Trump's election in November 2016 to the election in 2020, the energy sector lost half of its value. It went down 15% per year, annualized.
50%.
50% is the total decline in the S&P 500 energy sector. It's quite remarkable. You can't blame all that on Trump, right? I mean, you had a global pandemic in there. You had OPEC.
Yeah, you're not making a causation argument here.
Correct. I am not. But it is interesting if you just take that first cut view of, hey, this president should be good for this particular industry. Therefore, I'm going to bet a lot of money on that industry. It doesn't always work like that, and energy is a good example. I remember before this last election, we had some local energy leaders saying, hey, look, if Biden wins, it's going to be real bad for our industry. We're going to be talking about job cuts and all sorts of things. Since the election in November of 2020, so just a couple months ago, the energy sector is up 50%, 50%. So again, can't give the credit necessarily to Biden, but I think the market is looking ahead and saying, all right, we might have increased regulation, which means lower supply, which means higher prices, which means better returns for energy stocks.
And I truly hope that Wednesday, January 6th is a date that is just lost, doesn't matter a year, a decade from now. But can you tell me, what did the stock market do on that day?
The Dow rose 437 points, about 1.5%.
And you're referring to the day of the rioting and marching at the Capitol.
Correct. Yes, whatever terminology you want to put and, to it. Yeah.
Right. Yes. When people gathered at the Capitol, and it was up how much?
It was up. The Dow was up 437 points, and in fact, intraday was up over 600 points.
Right. And again, I think there was a lot of factors playing into that. But what I keep hearing you guys talk about is the fact that trying to gauge or trying to time an industry based purely on politics is foolish. And I mean that in a way of, it'd be foolish for us to try to do that when we're managing client assets.
Tyler, I think that's well said. We always want to look at the evidence and what that tells us. If the evidence said, hey, the market only goes up under Republican administrations, and here are the reasons why, and it tends to do poorly under Democrats, then we might change the way we invest. But the evidence does not say that. And in fact, everything that's happened over the last 4 years and going back much longer before that indicates that a disciplined, steady approach is going to outperform a market timing-based approach, whether it's based on factors, as we've talked about in the past, or whether it's based on politics.
We could talk about the political implications or lack thereof for as long as we got batteries on the microphone, but we got to get to Bitcoin and Tesla. What do you want next, Zach?
Let's talk about Bitcoin.
Which these will be real quick, right? these will be easy, short answers.
And I think as a disclaimer before we talk about either of these topics, Howard Marks' memos in general, but specifically Something of Value, the title of the memo is Something of Value, and Morgan Housel's book, Psychology of Money, are both very influential on how we approach specifically these topics, both as individuals and as a firm. How well does that satisfy your need to avoid taking credit for other people's work, Zach?
Pretty well. I can't recommend the book and the memo from Howard Marks highly enough. I think they're fantastic. And you know, a relatively short podcast, we can only get so deep. If you want to go deeper, both of those are excellent options.
So talking about Bitcoin, I want to try and get a framework. And at the risk of sounding arrogant, I am a pretty intelligent person, especially in the field of finance and investing.
Here, I will say you both are probably two of the smartest investment guys that I know. And I can't wait to watch you try to explain Bitcoin.
And that's what I was going to say. Zach, I don't get Bitcoin. Can you help me?
Here's the approach I took with Bitcoin. And this goes back several years now because I felt the same way as you guys. I didn't understand it. Another great resource that I would recommend if you're really interested in this topic is Patrick O'Shaughnessy's podcast, Invest Like the Best. He did a multi-part series having experts on Bitcoin on, cryptocurrencies in general, the blockchain technology. Went into great depth, and I certainly learned a lot from that. The other thing that, you know, I'm kind of a learn by doing sort of person. So I went and created a digital wallet on Coinbase. I figured out all the machinations to actually buy a Bitcoin. I wasn't a full Bitcoin. This was several years ago. I think the prices were certainly sub 10,000 at that point. But I bought a fraction of a Bitcoin. I think probably about $100 worth of Bitcoin. Tried to make some transaction buying something. I can't remember what. And then eventually sold the Bitcoin and got US dollars back in return. And that informed my experience a little bit. And I will tell you, it is, as you think about what role Bitcoin is supposed to play, is it a medium of exchange where you, like we use US dollars, where we buy pizzas, right? Or groceries or clothes or whatever it is. I would say it is very much not a convenient medium of exchange.
So what is Bitcoin then, as a, if it's not a medium of exchange or money currency, where is the value and purpose in Bitcoin originating from?
Yeah, I think you would get different answers and different arguments depending on kind of what your bias is. You know, for the Winklevoss twins, they'll argue that, yeah, Bitcoin is eventually going to replace fiat currency, and here's why. And they can make some good points. You can make that a compelling argument. And one of the reasons why is there's only so much Bitcoin that could be mined.
And in that case, the value proposition is if you add up the total fiat currency in the world and divide it by 23 million, which is the total Bitcoin, that's the value proposition on how much Bitcoin is worth. Is that not nuanced, but is that a fair proposition?
Some people can make that argument. You know, I would argue very vociferously that the U.S. government, and for those of you who don't know, Dexter is former property of U.S. government as a artillery officer. The U.S. government has a lot of tools, to put it nicely, that if they wanted to say Bitcoin is not something we're okay with because it threatens the power of the U.S. dollar, they have a lot of tools to stop Bitcoin. In fact, One thing that they've added to tax returns this year is a question, have you owned any digital currency in the last year? You have to declare that now as a U.S. citizen, otherwise you're lying on your tax return. I think that is the first step toward what could eventually be regulation. The other thing that is important to think about, Coinbase is now a publicly traded company, right? So they're regulated by the SEC. They're the kind of company you're going to go to open a digital wallet. If you don't think the U.S. government can get their list of customers, you are fooling yourself. So the idea that Bitcoin is this anonymous deal, you can go on there, you can make a bunch of money, you're never going to have to pay taxes on it, U.S. government can't touch you. I am incredibly skeptical of that point of view. So if that is your investment case, I just don't buy it. That's not to say there aren't other cases. And it's certainly not to say Bitcoin hasn't been a tremendous investment for a lot of people. There are Bitcoin centimillionaires, people who have made hundreds of millions of dollars from Bitcoin.
You and I both read the article today and we were chuckling about it. Can you talk about the almost centimillionaires real quick on Bitcoin?
Yes, the New York Times had a great story. One of Dexter and I's favorite writers, Matt Levine from Bloomberg, linked to it in his daily email today. But they wrote about how they estimate 20% of all Bitcoin is lost or stranded. And at today's prices, that's a...
Why is it lost or stranded as one of the primary causes?
Well, the biggest cause would be people forgot their password. And so since you guys haven't had a digital wallet, right? It's not like a password that you make for your email. When you do these passwords, they're incredibly long and complex, intentionally so, because if someone knows your password, then get in and take all your money, right? And that's why you hear the Winklevoss twins, who had the idea for Facebook before Zuckerberg, they've become very big into Bitcoin. So what they've done is they take their passwords, they cut them up into different pieces of paper, put them in different bank vaults all around the country, so that they can then bring them together. So that even if someone were to break into their bank vault, they wouldn't have the full password. That's the sort of security that they've gone through to protect their Bitcoin.
I read a similar story today. It popped up on my newsfeed, and it was a gentleman that has his password stored on his computer, clearly in an encrypted file or database. He cannot remember the password to get into the encrypted file. And it's set to, for lack of better words, explode internally after 10 attempts. And he's on 8 right now. And so he'll wake up in the middle of the night and he'll remember maybe this option and he'll go in there and do it. And so, I mean, I feel for the guy, but he's got, I can't remember the number of Bitcoin that he has, but it's a very expensive password that he forgot.
One of the people referenced in the New York Times article literally has $200 million worth of Bitcoin that he cannot access. And he's tried and tried and tried. Can't remember the password. He said he vacuum sealed his hard drives and so he doesn't have to look at them. And maybe someday he'll remember, but that's $140 billion at today's valuation that is lost, literally. And you know, Matt Levine makes the point that no one goes to sleep worried that they're going to wake up and they won't be able to access their Facebook stock or their S&P 500 index fund. That's just not a problem we have doing what we do. So it's a very interesting asset class.
As we transition to talking about Tesla, one of the ideas Morgan Housel talks about in Psychology of Money is understanding the game that is being played. He used that analogy specifically to describe the dot-com stocks and how so much of the volume was from day traders who were simply taking advantage of infinitely rising prices. Where does that idea of understanding what game is being played fit into your framework for understanding Bitcoin and Tesla?
I would separate them a little bit. They have a lot of similarities. But before we kind of fully move into Tesla, you ask the question, you know, what is Bitcoin? My stance on Bitcoin today is it is a extremely volatile, speculative investment that can be a lot of fun when it's going up, right? But ultimately, the game with Bitcoin is it's the greater fool theory, which is well known in economics. You're buying an asset and you're hoping that a greater fool comes along and he's willing to pay a higher price for that asset, right? Other than that, it doesn't produce cash flow, doesn't have any intrinsic value. People compare it, they say it's the digital gold. Gold at least has some uses, right? We use it in jewelry. There's some limited industrial uses for gold. You can't say that about Bitcoin. It is literally just what the next person's willing to pay for you.
Do either of you think the technology behind Bitcoin, from a cryptocurrency or digital asset, do you think that has some long-term appeal or value?
I love it. I love what crypto or what blockchain technology can do.
Thank you.
Yes.
Again, I'd recommend to any listener who wants to go deeper, Matt Levine's take on some of this. His frequent kind of joke is that it is a spreadsheet, which is what a blockchain is. I mean, at the end of the day, it is just a list of transactions. The really clever part about it, and I do agree, I think it's really interesting technology, although I think it gets overblown sometimes, is that it is trustless, meaning everyone can see it. You don't have to have one central repository that clears all that information. Everyone can see everything at the same time. One kind of interesting idea that I've heard talked about is when you think about when you buy property, you have to do a title search. You have to go to a closing company and they buy title insurance and all of these things because you have to be very sure that the person you're paying the money to actually has title to the property or the land, and then that you're going to be safe from someone else coming along and saying, no, that was actually my land. With the blockchain, you could eliminate a lot of those issues and you could make things like closing happen very much faster. Even things like stock settlement, which have gone from when I started my career from trade date plus 3 days to trade date plus 2 days now, you could have almost instantaneous stock settlement if you had, you know, a blockchain that was trusted. So I agree there are some really interesting ideas. I don't think that Bitcoin necessarily equates to the value of the blockchain technology, even though they're related, right? And I think that's where people can get tripped up a little bit sometimes.
That's fair. That's fair.
With regards to Tesla, how many conversations have you had where you tell people you work in wealth management and inevitably the conversation ends up going to Tesla?
A fair amount.
I just think it's an interesting dynamic. And I talked to Tyler about it as well and said the same thing. I'm going to give a few facts about Tesla. And then if you would, just let me know if it's an unfair comparison. We need to explain more. So my father-in-law and brother both own Tesla cars. I've driven them. It is the best driving experience I have ever had. Once you get used to the regenerative braking, it is the greatest car I think I've ever driven. Is there a direct causation between making an amazing product and turning a profit as a business?
Not always, but it definitely helps.
In Q3 of 2020, Tesla sold $400 million worth of energy credits, and they reported a net profit of $330 million as a firm. In other words, they lost $75 million or almost $830,000 a day making cars from June to September. Am I distorting any facts there?
No.
Another is the ownership profile of Tesla is really interesting to me in that they are owned 50% by retail investors. 15 to 20% of their ownership is short interest in terms of people who think the stock is going to go down. And the institutional ownership of it is considerably less based off of their profitability requirements there. How does that impact Tesla to you, Zach?
Well, I think you can look at it one of two ways. The first way would be, hey, retail investors perhaps don't do the homework that an institutional investor would do to make sure that the price is reasonable relative to reality, right? The other would be, and I think we're seeing this play out lately, that's an opportunity for Tesla to increase institutional ownership. And one of the reasons why institutional ownership was lower was because Tesla wasn't a member of the S&P 500 until very recently. It now is. So I think you're actually going to see that institutional ownership increase. And I think you can attribute some amount of the recent run-up we've seen in Tesla to its addition to an index.
Elon Musk is, in my opinion, a visionary entrepreneur who can kind of see where the Moore's Law doubling technology is going to take us on that exponential growth curve and is jumping us there and getting there, kind of getting there first. He also seems to be somewhat of a crazy person. And I use that as a descriptive term with no connotation. And I'm not sure if these things relate, matter, and sort of the following that he has developed as an entrepreneur and how that impacts Tesla's price.
When you think about Elon Musk, people who come to mind who are similar are, you know, people like Steve Jobs, who I think had some, having read his biography, some definite personal flaws and, you know, was crazy in some ways as well. I like the story about Steve Jobs when he asked his engineers, you know, have you gotten this iPhone as small as possible? And they said, yes, yes, Steve, we've gotten it as small as possible. He walks over to a fish tank and he drops it in there and a couple bubbles come up. And he said, nope, clearly there's some air in there. You've got to get this thing smaller. So, I mean, is that crazy? You know, probably so. It's a little crazy, but at the same time, he drove them to create a new product. And I think the best comparison between them is they both created a product category that effectively didn't exist before. And then they combined it with a cool factor, for lack of a better term, that just is very design forward. Teslas are amazing cars to drive. Full disclosure, I have ordered a Tesla. I don't have it yet, but I'm going to be a Tesla owner myself.
And you are saying you are an owner of the Tesla product, not directly the Tesla stock.
That's correct. Although, you know, certainly myself through the exchange traded funds we own and our clients do have exposure to Tesla stock, and happily so, given the run in the stock. But I think your point is, you know, do all of those things add up to Tesla being a good investment today? Certainly from a Benjamin Graham margin of safety value investing standpoint, Tesla looks insane. I don't think you can, you know, say anything different than that. But as Howard Marks wrote in his most recent memo, I think the world has changed a little bit in terms of growth investing, in terms of looking at companies like Amazon. So let's compare Amazon and Tesla for a second. Amazon started as a bookstore. We kind of forget about that now, right? Now they sell everything, but what maybe the average person on the street doesn't realize, Amazon Web Services is a massive component of the value of that company now. That was not something when Jeff Bezos started the company, a bookstore. You know, it wasn't a natural progression for them to get to into the web hosting business, but Amazon Web Services is very important now. The bull case that you're seeing more analysts talk about for Tesla is that with the amount of consumer loyalty they have and the brand value, eventually they can have other things that are very valuable. And I think you're even starting to hear some talk of them, whether it's a subscription service, battery subscriptions they've talked about. Obviously, they're in the solar panel business already. There's just a lot of things that potentially they could do if you believe that Elon Musk is not so crazy to blow it all up, ultimately.
And I'll kind of tie it back to the question I asked you guys about Bitcoin. I view Tesla almost more as a technology company than a car company. So, same question. Do you think, and I think you kind of just answered it, but I think the technology and the leader of Tesla is something that people should be confident in going forward, but maybe not quite as far as, yeah, we want to own Tesla outright as a stock. Right. But the technology, the makeup of the company is encouraging.
It is. You know, my default worldview is that markets are generally efficient. And that means that prices generally reflect close to reality. That worldview gets challenged all the time, but I think it is generally useful when we think about how to invest. So if you assume that is true, Tesla's market cap today is $800 billion. That's what people are valuing, you know, the entire company at. I will read you a few stats though that could lead you to say, hey, this doesn't necessarily seem efficient. It seems like people are maybe going a little overboard. I'm going to give you the number of trading days from market cap increases. So Tesla went from 100 billion to 200 billion in 111 market days, 200 billion to 300 billion in 13, 300 billion to 400 billion, 27 market days, 400 to 500, 63 days. It went from 500 billion to 600 billion in 8 days, and then 600 billion to 700 billion in 18 days. What that implies, if you fully believe the market's truly efficient, is that something in the last 6 months or so increased the value of that company by $700 billion. Let's bring it back to kind of a fundamental investing standpoint. They delivered 500,000 cars. Now, those cars are expensive, right? They're not cheap cars. Worldwide, in 2019, 92 million cars were produced. In the United States alone, 11 million cars were produced. So Tesla produced less than 5% of vehicles in the U.S., the market cap of Facebook is higher than the next 10 car makers combined. If you look at it today, As you said, Dexter, they're making more from selling energy credits than actually selling cars. You know, you can't justify an $800 billion valuation. You have to be looking far into the future and believing that they're going to be able to create value at some point in the future. Whether that happens or not, I don't know. That's part of the risk of investing. That's why we get to make returns, because we're exposing ourselves to risk intentionally. But I don't think comparing that to something like, hey, let's invest in Procter & Gamble, because and Procter & Gamble is a good company, and we do invest in Procter & Gamble. But if you're going to say, you know, and all this would have been true 5 years ago about Tesla and Procter & Gamble too. Procter & Gamble, strong company, great brand, very predictable cash flows, lower valuation in that it had a calculable price to earnings.
You could use the discounted cash flow method.
You could actually do some fundamental analysis on the company, whereas Tesla was a money-losing company with a kind of crazy CEO who smoked pot on Joe Rogan's podcast and literally was almost bankrupt. I mean, he is now the richest man in the world. And he was
crazy.
He almost was completely out of money. You know, which one was a better investment back then? I mean, obviously Procter & Gamble would seem like the safer investment. And for many people who manage money, and Howard Marks writes about this too, they have a conservative bias and they want to do things that feel more conservative. But if that's the approach you take, then you miss out on Tesla, Amazon, et cetera.
I cannot in any way dispute the returns that have come from Bitcoin and Tesla over the last short period of time. I think where my contention comes from is the average person I talk to at the gym who is trying to talk about these things doesn't necessarily understand the value propositions that exist in these. And I have no problem with buying Bitcoin as a speculative investment. I have no problem buying Tesla as a 10-year return based off of their ancillary services that are yet to be known. I think that the hard part I have is whenever they are bought as a profitable car company in the present day. And I struggle to connect that to reality.
Yeah. And I mean, that's why I think people need to know and understand what they're buying. I've had a lot of family members ask me about things like Bitcoin. And I just say, hey, look, it's not for me. I think it's very speculative. I can't value it. But, you know, I have friends and family who go to Las Vegas and they play, you know, craps too. We've talked about this in the past. Some of it is fun. I think Jason Zweig in the Wall Street Journal wrote recently about this. And he said something like, take 1% of your money and allocate it toward a fund money account. If that's where you want to buy your Bitcoin or make a bet on Tesla or the next Tesla, I think that's where you do it. He had a few great tips there, rules like don't add money to it, right? Don't make it a greater percentage of your overall portfolio than you should. To bring it back to kind of how we think about these potential investments at Full Sail Capital, you know, Dexter, I agree with you. If I were picking stocks, I don't think I could pull the trigger on buying Tesla. I think the world has changed in a way, though.
And you are saying buying Tesla in a significantly greater percentage than what its market cap is in the consumer discretionary sector.
Exactly right. And the world now has changed to where the default, I believe, needs to be you start with the index, right? And in that case, it's worked great that we've had exposure to these stocks.
Absolutely.
Right? And I think until there's some better way based on evidence that we can do it, I think that's the approach we'll continue to take.
I know you got to get back to work here. But so if I'm hearing you correctly, you are happy that we own Tesla and you are happy that we own it in the manner that we do in the percentage of the client money that it represents.
Absolutely. Tesla will, you know, and you and I have talked about this in the past, we'll know in 10 years whether it is the Apple of the car business, which, by the way, Apple is also going to get into the car business. So Apple might have something to say about that. Maybe they take over. Maybe they have 80% market share, Tesla or Apple. Who knows? The thing I know for sure is that we will have exposure to both of those stocks. And we may, you know, look back and have very little Tesla exposure because it shrunk as a percentage of market cap. We may have a lot more because it continues to grow. The evidence just tells us if we miss out on the Teslas, the Amazons, the Apples of the world, we are going to do our clients a great disservice and their returns are going to be much lower than they would be otherwise.
Are you planning on paying for your Tesla with Bitcoin when it arrives?
If I just mined a few Bitcoins back then, you know, it would be like a free Tesla.
Thanks for coming by, Zach.
Thanks, Zach.
Thanks.
All opinions expressed by the host and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Full Sail Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Full Sail may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. If you enjoyed today's conversation, please review and subscribe through your preferred podcast platform. Have a great week.